Thank you for inviting me to this workshop. So I will talk about the graph in Big N equality, and I will prove that the graph in Big constant is strictly smaller than Krivine's bound. This is a joint work with Mark Breverman, Konstantin Makarichev, and Asaf Nawar. So in this talk at first, I will present the graph in Big N equality and define the graph in Big constant. I will show you at first applications of this inequality in mathematics, quantum mechanics, and computer science. Then I will show you the proof of Krivine that the graph in Big constant is less than Krivine's bound. And later I will prove that actually the graph in Big constant is strictly less than Krivine's bound. So the graph in Big inequality was introduced in 1953 by Alexander Grothendieck in his paper Reason Math. In this paper, he studied tensor products of Banach spaces. So he wanted to study linear operators from Banach spaces using tensor products. And it's the first name or the first word of his paper. There's a mere something in French, I don't remember the name. But it's often now called a resume. And it's interesting that this paper at first was forgotten and it wasn't actually noticed because it was presented at a conference in Latin America, and at that point of time there was no internet, so people probably just didn't know about it. And this paper was rediscovered in 1968 or around that time. And at that point, it turned out that this paper resolved many open problems that were posed after this paper was originally published in 1953. And this paper was very influential in the development of functional analysis in the second part of the 20th century. So in this paper, Grothendieck posed 6 open problems, and all of them, except one, were resolved by 1981, and this one problem was to find the value of the Grothendieck constant. This problem is still open. So let me first give the motivation why Grothendieck was interested in the Grothendieck inequality and what this inequality is. So suppose that we are given 2 Banach spaces U and V, and our goal is to norm spaces, yes. If they're infinite dimensional, they are also complete, but we will deal with finite dimensional spaces, so these are just normed spaces. And our goal is to study natural norms on the tensor product of U and V, and in the finite dimensional case, we just want to study, in a sense, matrices, and to consider different norms on the space of matrices. So if you have, if you know the norms of spaces U and V, there are actually many different ways to define the norm on this tensor product U times V, and there are many ways to define this norm that satisfies many nice properties. So let's consider an example. For example, consider the case where U and V are L1 spaces, and we want to define the L1 norm on the set of n by n matrices. So what is the most natural way? One, at least informally natural way, is just to take the sum of absolute values of all matrix entries, right? This is similar to what we do with vectors. And this norm is indeed a valid norm on the set of matrices, and this norm is called the projective norm. We can get another definition of the norm if we consider the dual characterization of L1. So we can say that the L1 norm of a vector is equal to the maximum of sum xi ui, where these numbers xi take values plus or minus 1. Right? And of course, this sum is maximized when xi is just equal to the sine of ui. And in this case, this expression is equal to the sum of absolute values of ui's. So this is another definition of the L1 norm for vectors, and there is a similar definition for the norm on matrices. So we can maximize this expression, sum hij xi yj over all values of xi and yj in minus 1 plus 1. And this is, again, a valid definition of the norm. And it turns out that this definition is different from the previous definition. And this norm is called the injective norm. So what Rosenbeck proved, that any norm on the set of matrices lies between the injective and projective norm. And so I gave the definitions for the case of the L1 space. It is possible to generalize this definition to arbitrary spaces. Another very important norm is the projection norm. Is the factorization norm. So the factorization norm of a matrix is equal to the maximum of this form over all unit vectors ui vj. Any questions? It should satisfy some nice properties, which I don't want to present now because I will not use it in this talk. But yeah. No. Right. But there are some additional properties. It should be of course consistent with the norms on U and V in some way. But I don't want to talk now about that in detail. This is right. Yes. At every. Right. Yes. For every matrix A. So this norm actually is very useful. This projection. This factorization norm. And roughly speaking, it says how well this map A, if you look at matrix A as a map, factorizes through a Hilbert space. So, in particular, since any norm lies between the injective and the projective, because any norm lies between the injective and projective norms, also the factorization norm lies between these two norms. And the Grothendieck inequality says that actually this factorization norm is equivalent to the injective norm. So this inequality holds where kg is an absolute constant. And the best possible constant k in this inequality is called the Grothendieck constant. Let's see what this inequality says. Just from the point of view, if we are interested in norms, it says that these two norms are equivalent up to this constant. And if you look at infinite dimensional spaces, in particular, this means that these two norms define the same topology. So it's a very important property. But let's look at what explicitly this inequality says. So it says that this maximum of sum aij ui inner product vj is less than the Grothendieck constant type times this maximum, where numbers xi and yj take plus minus one values. So this is the Grothendieck inequality. So this inequality has numerous applications in analysis, and it also has applications in quantum mechanics, and recently there has been a lot of interest into this inequality in computer science. And now I will briefly talk about this application. So the application to quantum mechanics is related to the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen paradox. Consider, let me explain this paradox. So consider, suppose that we have three parties, Alice, Bob, and Charlie, and Alice and Bob are located very far from each other and from Charlie. So Charlie perform some experiment and sends two particles, one particle to Alice and the other particle to Bob. The spins of these particles are opposite, and the spins are random. So this probability half the spin of the particle that is sent to Alice is up, this probability half it is down. And then Alice and Bob perform the measurement, and they get, of course, some directions up, down, up, 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 say, and then Bob gets directions down, up, down, down, so they're opposite. Now, the quantum mechanics says that actually these spins are random, but more importantly that the spins are actually the results of the measurements are not determined before the measurement. So before Alice and Bob measure the spins of their particles, actually these spins are not determined. And they got determined only one, only once one of these two parties makes, performs the measurement. And this is sort of quite counterintuitive, because Alice and Bob may be very far from each other, but once one of them measures the spin of his or her particle, the spin of the other particle gets determined right away, even though they can be many at a great distance from each other. And so Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen thought that this is a paradox and this is a contradiction in quantum mechanics. So what they proposed that actually probably this assumption that the spins of particles are not determined before the measurement is not correct. And they assume that actually there is a hidden variable. So each particle has a hidden variable that determines the result of the measurement. And for a long time, it was thought that this is just sort of philosophical difference between two interpretations of quantum mechanics. But in 1964, Bell understood that actually the hidden variable theory is testable. And in 1980, Thurston actually noted that the Bell inequality is very closely related to the Grothendieck inequality. Let me explain his interpretation. So suppose that we are given an n by n matrix W and consider the following test. So for every I and j between 1 and n, we do the following. So we tell Alice the value of I, and we tell the Bob the value of j. Now Alice and Bob receive their particles, and each of them should say either plus 1 or minus 1. And let qij be the product of these two numbers. And we look at this sum over all I and j, wij times qij. So this test is very similar to tests that we study in computer science. The goal of Alice and Bob is to maximize this form. So it turns out that if the hidden variable theory is true, then the maximum value of this form is equal to the, of course, expectation over the hidden variable of this number, and this is just equal to the maximum over all xi and yj of this quadratic form. But it turns out that if the quantum mechanics is true, then the maximum of this form is equal to this value. And this value is sum of wij, the inner product of ui and vj. And now, it turns out that this quantity can be larger, but that this quantity, so actually the quantum mechanics can be tested experimentally and the hidden variable theory can be falsified. And the Grothendieck constant says exactly what advantage Alice and Bob can get using quantum mechanics, and it shows the optimal parameters in the Bell inequality. And now let me return to computer science. And in computer science, the Gross-Indic inequality was introduced by Alon and Auer. So they considered the following optimization problem. Our goal is to maximize the form sum hij times xi yj subject to the constraint that xi and yj take values plus and minus 1. So consider the standard SDP relaxation of this problem. So we replace each xi with a vector ui and each yj with a vector vj. And our goal is now to maximize this form subject to the constraint that all vectors ui and vj are unit vectors. Now, the Gross-Indic inequality just says that the integrality gap of this SDP relaxation is equal to the Gross-Indic constant. So using SDP, we can get approximation factor equal to the Gross-Indic constant. And moreover, Rugavendra and Sturer show that this algorithm is optimal. So there is no way to get a better approximation in polynomial time unless Vinnie-Gaines conjecture is false. This inequality and closely related little Gross-Indic inequality has numerous applications for solving specific constraint satisfaction problems and combinatorial optimization problems, in particular for computing the cut norm of the matrix, for solving the maximum KCSP problem, a maximum acyclic subgraph problem, and large margin classifiers. So now there are a lot of applications of this inequality in combinatorial optimization, and also it was generalized in mathematics, in computer science, and in physics to other types of inequalities. What do we know about the Gross-Indic constant? So the best currently known bound on the Gross-Indic constant is due to Krivine. So he proved that the Gross-Indic constant is less than one than this number pi over 2 logarithm of 1 plus square root of 2. And this is approximately 1.782. The best lower bound is due to Reed, who proved that the Gross-Indic constant is greater than 1.67. So we don't know even the first digit after the period. In fact, Krivine conjectured that the Gross-Indic constant is equal to his upper bound, and Koenig made a certain conjecture that implied that Krivine's conjecture is true. So Koenig, in 2001, made a conjecture that implied that the Gross-Indic constant is actually equal to this number. We disprove this conjecture, and we show that actually the Gross-Indic constant is strictly less than Krivine's bound. And we also disprove Koenig's conjecture. First I want to describe how Krivine proved his upper bound, and then I will show how to prove a stronger bound on the Gross-Indic constant. So recall that we consider the SDP solution to this objective function. So we have vectors ui, vj that maximize the sum of aij, ui, dot product vj. So the Krivine's rounding scheme at first transforms these vectors. So we map each vector ui to some vector L of ui in a Hilbert space or in high-dimensional Euclidean space, and we map each vector vj to some vector R of vj, again in a high-dimensional space. And then we just use the hyperplane rounding and apply it to this vector. So we take a random hyperplane, and if the vector L of u lies in one-half space, then we map it to plus 1. If it lies in the other half space, we map it to minus 1. So this is the same procedure as Gomez and Williamson use as the last step. Let me now describe it in more detail. So these maps L of U and R of V are defined by these formulas. So this is an infinite series. We take U, then we take the third tensor power of U divided by the square root of 3 factorial and take the sum. All these vectors U, U tensor power 3, U tensor power 5 lie in orthogonal spaces. So they lie in different spaces and we just take the direct sum of all the spaces. Of course, we take these coefficients because this coefficient is equal to the square root of the third coefficient of the sine expansion. And this coefficient is equal to the square root of the fifth coefficient of sine expansion. So if you take the inner product of L of U and R of V, then it's just equal the inner product of U and V, then the inner product of these two vectors, and the inner product of these two vectors is equal to the inner product of U and V cubed divided by the square root of 3 factorial squared, which is equal to 3 factorial. So because of our choice of this transformation, we get that the inner product of L of U and R of V is equal to this series. And this is the series of the sine function, so we get that this inner product is equal to the sine of the inner product of U and V. So of course we chose this transformation exactly to get this equality. So now we take a random hyperplane, and it's convenient to think of it as follows. So we choose a random Gaussian vector gamma in high-dimensional space. So each component of this vector is distributed as a normal variable with mean 0 and variance 1. And then we take the inner product. So let xi be the sine of this vector, L of square root t ui inner product with gamma, and yj is equal to this, where we take this normalization constant so that these vectors L of square root tui and R of square root tvg are unit vectors. And then what we get that the expected value of the product of xi and yj is equal to 2 over pi of the arcsine of the inner product of these vectors. So this is the same analysis and as in the Gomez-Williamson algorithm. And since now we know just by our choice of this transformation that the inner product of these two vectors, L of square root tui and R of square root tvj, is equal to the sine of the square root of these vectors of the argument, and arc sine and sine cancel each other, so we get that this is equal to 2 c over pi times the inner product of ui and vj. So what do we get? We get this expression, right? And therefore, the expected value of this solution, of this integral solution, xi yj, is equal to 2c over pi times the value of the HDP solution. What we get is 2c over pi approximation ratio. And it's not hard to see that the value of c for which these vectors are unit vectors is equal to the logarithm of 1 plus square root of 2, and therefore we get 2 log 1 plus over plus square root of 2 over pi approximation. So this number is the inverse of the Krivin constant. And this is how Krivin proved his upper bound. Now, let's try to modify his argument. So let's try to use slightly different parameters. So in his construction, in this construction, we use the following formulas, right? Xi is equal to the sine of this, and yj is equal to sine of this expression. Can we actually replace this function sine and this transformation L and R by some other functions? Can we use different transformations of L and R? And our hope, of course, is to change these functions and transformations and get, again, that the expectation of xi, of the product of xi and yj is equal to the inverse of k times the inner product of ui and vj. It is a constant k less than the Gauss index, less than Kreevin's, it should be k, less than Kreevin's constant. And in 2001, Koenig proved a result that implied that this is not possible. So this is the optimal choice of functions and transformations. But he proved it only for a one-dimensional case. So let's try to generalize this scheme to a higher dimension. So what does it mean? So in the original Kreevin rounding, we have these formulas. But let's take two projections. So instead of taking one Gaussian gamma and taking this projection and computing this transformation, let's have one transformation, but then take the inner product with one Gaussian vector and completely independent another Gaussian vector, gamma 2. So for each vector ui, now we have two numbers, this inner product and this inner product. And xi is equal to f of these two numbers, and yj is equal to g of correspondingly these two numbers. So let me again explain what the scheme does. So at first, we have vectors ui and vj. These vectors come from the HDP solution, right? Then we transform these vectors, so we map ui to this vector, vj to this vector, so we get new vectors. And now, in a sense, we project it on a random two-dimensional plane. So more specifically, we take the products with Gaussian vectors, but roughly speaking, we just project these vectors on a two-dimensional random plane. So we have this plane, and we have some function f defined on this plane. At some point, this function is equal to plus 1. At some point, this function is equal to minus 1. So let's say orange is plus 1 and black is minus 1. Then if the projection of point u1 happens to be here, we map u1 to minus 1. If the projection is here, then we map it to plus 1, and so on. And we get our rounding. What do we get? The expected value of xi, of the inner product xi and yj is equal to the expectation of f of s g of t, where s and t are these two points on the plane, the projections of these transformed vectors, right? What do we know about vectors S and T? S and T are two-dimensional Gaussian vectors, and components S1 and T1 are correlated, and components S2 and T2 are correlated. And the correlation is equal to the product of our original vectors, L of our transformed vectors L of square root C UI and R of square root C VG. And we want to compute this expectation. So note that the only relevant information about points S and T is their correlation. So it doesn't actually matter. If you want to compute this expectation, it doesn't matter what these vectors exactly are. The only thing that interests us is the inner product of these vectors. So this is similar to Gomez and Williamson. So even though that this inner product is equal to rho, then this the expectation of this product is equal to the expectation of f of s times g of t, where s and t are raw correlated. And let's just define this function h f g of raw to be equal to this expectation. In the Cribbins rounding scheme, the expectation of the product of xi and yj was proportional to the inner product of ui and vj. And we again want this property to hold. So we want to have this equality. And here it's important that we have exact equality and not only approximate equality, because in the Grothendieck inequality we can have positive and negative elements. So if we have just a bound that this expectation is greater than this inner product divided by some constant, then it is not enough. The coefficient between xi and times yj can be negative, and in this case we actually need equality here. So in order we want to have this equality, then we want to ensure that this function h of the product of L of U and R of V is equal to the product U of V. At least we can demand this condition if we normalize vectors L and R. So in general, we want to have some coefficient here, but by normalization, we may assume that this coefficient is equal to 1. So let's try to find such functions F, G, L, and R. In fact, it turns out that once we fix functions F and G, we can always find such functions L and R pretty much uniquely, at least if we make some assumptions. So our goal will be to find good functions f and g, and then given these functions f and g, we will be able to reconstruct transformations L and R. So okay, we write this equality as follows. So we just compute the inverse of these functions h, and what we want? We want to have this. Now we use the same trick as Krivin did. So we take the function h inverse, consider its Taylor series, and then define L of U as follows and R of V as follows. It's easy to see then the inner product of L of U and R of V is equal to this expression, right? So this identity holds just by our choice of this coefficient. The product of this coefficient and this coefficient is always equal to B2k plus 1. Any questions? We assume that it is an odd function, right?
And it's clear that that's
without those rules. In a sense, yes. But what we are describing, actually, I sort of explained how to come up with our construction. But actually, we don't need. I can just give you L and R in order to prove that the Grothendieck constant is smaller than Cribbins bound. But pretty much, yeah. I mean, of course, we have some assumptions, but. About what? Yeah, alternation science. I didn't tell anything about that. Yes. I don't have any constraints so far. I assume, of course, that H converges and that it has a Taylor series. In general, not any function have Taylor series. It turns out that in no matter which functions f and g we take, the function H defined as false will have Taylor series. Okay, and also I sort of I don't prove that these series converge, but again this is true. Now let's compute the approximation factor. So what is the approximation factor? We get this equality, right? Just by our choice of h, we have that the inner product of these two vectors is equal to the inner product of the arguments. Sorry, I mean this expression is equal to the inner product of these two arguments, and it is equal to c times ui vj. So the approximation factor is equal to c. So c is less than 1, and the Grothendieck constant will be 1 over c. And c is chosen so that these vectors are unit vectors. And or in other words, if we compute the L2 norm of these vectors, then it is equal to this expression, right? So these are definitions of L and R. When we square these coefficients, we get these numbers. So C is defined as the solution of this equality. So what is our plan? We want to find two functions f and g from the Euclidean plane to plus minus 1, then compute this correlation function h, invert it, obtain the Taylor series, solve the equation for c, find c, and we get k is equal to 1 over c approximation. So this sketch shows that the Grothendieck constant is less than 1 over c. And if we want to just to prove that the Grothendieck constant is less than Krivine's bound, then we need to show that c is greater than 1 over Krivine's bound, right? And using this definition of c and the fact that this function is monotonically increasing, we see it suffices to show that if you plug in 1 over the Krivine's bound in this equation, then we get the number which is less than 1. So if you prove this, inequality, then we will see that the Grothendieck constant is strictly less than Krivine's bound. Any questions? If what happens to be, the coefficients of H will not be positive. And actually this scheme is a generalization of the Krivine rounding scheme. And in the Krivine rounding scheme, this series is sine alternating. So I mean the coefficients are equal to the coefficients of the sine function, so it's if we look only at odd coefficients, then they're sine alternating. And now it's time to make this assumption. So let's assume that actually these coefficients are that this series is sine alternating. So B1 is positive, B3 is negative, B5 is positive, and so on. I mean, there is pretty much no good reason to make the assumption, except that we just need it. So in this case, we can write that this number is equal to minus 1 to the power k times b to k plus 1, times c to the power of 2k plus 1, right? Or we can write it in a strange way like this. So this is the same number as we had. So I just rewrite this expression in this a little bit strange way, and here I is the square root of minus 1. So I don't do anything smart here. And then, so we have this equation for c, And we can rewrite it. We use this identity for each term, and we get the sum of these terms, right? But this is exactly, so when we get the value of this series for H inverse at point IC divided by I. So we get actually that the optimal value of C for this scheme satisfies this this equation, and now we can write this this equation in a much simpler form. So it's not, now it's not the sum of some series is equal to one, but rather we have this short identity. And our goal now is to find functions f and g that maximize this this expression. So we know that t is equal to this expression, but it doesn't have intuitive meaning because originally this correlation function was defined as expectation of this product where these points s and t are rho correlated. And of course, rho was a number between one, minus 1 and 1. So actually what we do, we consider this function and extend it to the complex plane, and it turns out that it is possible to do that. And then it's possible to show that actually this expression is equal to this expression. It's just some computation. So our goal now is to find functions f and g that maximize this expression. And in particular, what we want to find functions f and g such that this expectation is greater than the expectation for the sine function, for this sine function. Because if we use the sine function, then we get the Krivine's bound. If we get something greater than this expectation from the Krivine scheme, then we get then we improve the bound on Krivine's constant, on the Bertrand constant, sorry. And of course, also we need to find the functions f and g such that this scheme is sine alternating, so that the series we talked about is sine alternating. Let's at first focus on our first goal, and let's find functions f and g such that this expectation is greater than this expectation. So consider functions f and g that maximize this expectation. Then we must satisfy the following identities. So if we fix f, then of course f of s should be equal to the expectation of this expression for a fixed s and random t. And similarly, if we fix t and choose s at random, then g of t should be equal to the sine of the expectation of the product of f of s and this sine of the inner product of s and t. So we should have, if f and g are optimal, we should have these identities. So in other words, we have a transformation that map a pair of functions f and g to a new pair of functions f and g, and we want to find a fixed point of this transformation. Okay? So we don't know that any fixed point is good, but we know that the optimal choice of f and g is a fixed point of this transformation. One fixed point is just the sine function, sine of the first coordinate. And this is a scheme that was used by Krivine. So I mean, in this case, we essentially use only one dimension. So this is a one-dimensional scheme which was used by Krivine. But we want to find other fixed points. And actually, we don't know what they are, but computationally, we know that numerically, we know that this is the best choice of functions fng. So we just use this iterative procedure and computed optimal fng many times, and always the computation converged to these two functions. We have no idea what these two functions are, so functions f and g are different, but if we just rotate the plane, then we will get the function g from the function f. And of course, if we rotate f and g in the same way, then we will get another optimal set of another optimal pair of functions. So it's actually a very interesting question, in our opinion, to understand what these functions f and g are, but in our proof, we don't use them because we don't know how to prove anything about them specifically. So our idea is to take this set, this fixed point, and try to a little bit perturb functions f and g and find. First of all, we don't know whether that we have alternating signs, but this is not the main issue. The main issue is that we just don't know how to prove that. I mean, we have a key. I mean, we use computer simulation to find them, so we don't have a rigorous proof. We can't prove rigorously anything about them. So instead, we used a different argument. So let's take these fixed points. And let's slightly perturb it. So f and g are sign of x1, so it means that if x1 is positive, then the function is equal to plus 1. If x1 is negative, then the function is equal to minus 1. And let's just say that if x1 is greater than some function epsilon time some function of x2, then these functions are positive. If x1 is less than this, then the function is negative. Of course, if epsilon is equal to 0, then we get just this fixed point. If epsilon is close to 0, then these two functions are close to these functions, but they're a little bit different. And okay, we need to ensure that functions f and g are odd functions, so this function h is an odd function. And then we can use this expectation and consider the Taylor series. It turns out that no matter which function h we take, this number a will always be in the Taylor series, this coefficient A will always be non-positive, so we cannot get obtain anything here. So we find a function H such that A is equal to 0 and B is positive. And one such example, the simplest example, is just H of X2 is equal to the fifth Hermite polynomial. And in this case, we get that here B is strictly positive, we get that this expectation is equal to some coefficient times epsilon to the power of 4 plus some other Taylor coefficient. And this means that if epsilon is small enough, then actually we gain something, and we improve the Kriven Roundjian scheme. So these are good news. The bad news that we had an assumption that this Taylor series is sine alternating. And probably the Taylor series that we get is not sine alternating. It's actually very hard to say what happens if epsilon is small. And it's not even possible to computationally find the Taylor coefficient. On the other hand, when epsilon tends to 0, these coefficients tend to coefficients of the sine function. So they tend to these numbers, and if epsilon is small enough, then signs of the first n coefficients coincide with signs of the coefficients of the sine function, right? So if epsilon is small enough, then first n coefficients are actually sine alternating. So by taking small enough epsilon, we can ensure that an arbitrarily large segment of the Taylor series is sine alternating. Recall that our goal was to show that this expression, when we plug in x is equal to 1 over Krivine bound, is less than 1. And we can write it as follows. We can decompose it into two terms. We can write this expression where we assume sort of that the series is sine alternating, and this error term. So after the nth term, the series is not sine alternating, so we lose at most this error term. Because if always we, I take the sum to infinity. So first I need to cancel this contribution and then actually, any questions? I want to show that this is less than one. One problem here that this expression is 1 minus theta of epsilon to the power of 4. So it really badly depends on epsilon, and coefficients B can be pretty large, so it's not clear how to analyze this right away. So we need an additional trick here. So let's combine this rounding scheme with the original Krivine rounding scheme. So we do the same steps, and we use one transformation of vectors. So we have some transformation of vectors L and R, and we apply it to these vectors U, R, and V, G. But instead of computing the values of functions F and G, this probability 1 minus P, where P is a parameter, use F and G is equal to the original Krivine function, and this probability P, we use our perturbed functions F epsilon and G epsilon. So this is a combination of two rounding schemes, our scheme and original Krivine's rounding scheme. And here, so the first two steps are common. We use one transformation of vectors UI and VJ, and then we always project these vectors onto two-dimensional random plane. But here, with some probability, we use one function for all points, and with another probability, 1 minus p, we use another function, f and g. It's not hard to see when actually this correlation function h is equal to the sum, to the convex combination of the original correlation function and p times our perturbed correlation function. We prove that actually the inverse of H is a well-defined holomorphic function in the disk of radius roughly 0.6, and then the difference between this function and the Krivine's function is proportional to P, where P is this parameter with which we use our scheme. So this is very small. And this proof is pretty technical, but intuitively, what is good about about this function H, that is just a linear function of P. So the analysis is not too complicated. And now we use Cauchy formula, and we bound the difference between the coefficients B and the coefficients of the sine function. So this difference is less than, we use Cauchy formula, is less than x over 0.6. 0.6 is the radius of this disk to the power of 2k plus 1. And this difference is proportional again to this parameter p. Okay, so what do we get? We get this bound, and now this bound is very nice because x is less than 0.6, so what we prove that these coefficients decay as a geometric progression, and also the bound is proportional to this parameter p. And now we are ready to obtain the desired result. So again, we want to prove that this expression is less than 1. Now, this number, the first term, is 1 minus theta of p. So here what we do, we fix epsilon, and now we change p. So epsilon is fixed. It's a small epsilon, but fixed epsilon, and we change p. Now this term only depends on p, and it decreases linearly with p for a fixed epsilon. Of course, it's something like p times epsilon to the power of 4, but epsilon is fixed. And this term is proportional to p. And by choosing, moreover, when we decrease p, then n increases. So if we choose p small enough, then n will be very high, and this coefficient before p will be much smaller than the coefficient before p here. So we will get something which is smaller than 1. Yes? X is 1 over Krivine bound. So in this case, it's 0.5 something. It's important that it's more than the Krivine, one of the Krivine bound. Yeah. This is not the optimal constant that we can get. So 0.6 is not is not equal to the radius of convergence, but it's just simpler to explain this way. And therefore, we get that the smaller p, right. If p is small, then the series becomes closer and closer to the series of sine, and therefore more and more terms will have the same sign as the series of sine. And because of that, if p is small enough, we can guarantee that arbitrarily many terms have the same sign as in the series for sine. Exactly. So this n actually depends on p. I mean, of course, it's true for smaller n as well, but we can increase n when we decrease p. And therefore, this is less than 1. Any questions? So let me then conclude. So what we did, we proved that the Grothendieck constant is less than Krivine's constant. We just proved Kernighan's conjecture, and there are several interesting questions. First of all, it's interesting to understand what is the optimal choice of functions f and g in two dimension, and it's probably even more interesting when what the optimal choice of f and g in higher dimension, and especially when the dimension tends to infinity. Actually, in our paper, we have certain conjectures that, if true, will give the exact value of the Grothendieck constant. One natural question is to compute the Grothendieck constant, and another interesting question is to try to use similar approach to other constraint satisfaction problems. In particular, it's interesting whether we can use complex analysis to analyze the performance of other algorithms, and that's it. Thank you.